Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Today we're going to dive back into ancient history. As you probably know by now, every now and then I like to do. And we are going to talk about Hannibal, who was the great military general for the Carthage civilization back in the 3rd century BC. Joining me here in the studio to talk about all this is Patrick N. Hunt. Patrick N. Hunt is an archaeologist. He's a historian. He's a biographer. He teaches at Stanford University. He also works with National Geographic, and he is the author of the book that we'll be in conversation about. It's called Hannibal. Patrick Hunt, it's my very good pleasure to welcome you to our radio station.
Mitch, it's a pleasure to be here.
Okay. In the popular imagination about the ancient world, people immediately think about Greece, Rome, Babylon, Egypt, but maybe not so much about Carthage. And if people do think, and this is where the story of Hannibal comes into, and if people do think about Carthage, it's just a side story. What's more about Rome. So let's begin by talking about Carthage. Tell me how Carthage sits in the narrative of world history.
Well, Mitch, it's a story that probably has been sublimated because Rome won.
Yeah.
And
victors always tell the story.
Exactly. The victors rewrite or write the history. And so we know there were a lot of things in Carthage written down. We have references to Carthaginian and Phoenician historians. While Romans may quote them, the actual works don't survive. And yet Carthage is a colony of a much older civilization. The very name that we call Carthage today was originally in Phoenician, Kart Hadasht, the new establishment of the god, you know, Melkart, the god of sort of cities and so on. And somewhere in the end of the 9th century BCE, Phoenicia is sending out all these ships because they control the Mediterranean. And they are establishing trade colonies. They are not so much a land-based culture. Sure, they have ports, wonderful ports all over the Mediterranean and even beyond, but they are, for the most part, interested in the economy of trade. They are not really a farming culture. Of course, they do have some lands, but they have a lot of allies. And when Carthage was founded, as I said, there's this great story about the founding of Carthage that says that Queen Elissa, or even Dido, as she's called, fled Tyre. Sort of her brother and her husband had a feud,
Tyre is the capital of Carthage.
That's right. Tyre was the mother city.
Spelled T-Y-R-E,
yes.
So people may recognize
yes,
that now.
Tyre, yeah. Which is in current Lebanon.
Yeah.
So the Carthaginians' parents, i.e. the Phoenicians, sent these colonies out, and apparently Utica was established a little before Carthage. But the famous story is that Carthage was founded because Dido sets up base in what would today be Tunisia. In fact, Carthage is surrounded by Tunis and the Gulf of Tunis, a port in a bay inside the Mediterranean on the coast of North Africa. So when Dido wanted land, she basically had to negotiate with the locals. And they said, okay, you can have as much land on this hill that you can have in an oxhide. Well, an oxhide can't be very big. So what she did, apparently, clever woman, she cut the entire oxhide into one long thong. Just cut, and started going from the outside, cutting in, and made a very long, if you wish, leather shoestring that must have been a mile long. And she then enclosed that land on the top of this hill within this leather thong, this leather tiny lace. And that was then called, because of one of the words for oxhide, was a bursa. That became the Bursa Hill, and that was the start of Carthage. So it started out with a clever sort of exploiting of what she could get out of those locals. And then Carthage grew and grew.
So I want to stop right there for a moment.
Sure.
Only because, and it'll become very apparent in our conversation, my enthusiasm and appetite for this knowledge is far heavier than the actual knowledge that I have about the ancient world, never mind Carthage itself. But if we're talking about, and I want you to correct me if I'm wrong here, if we're talking about 9th century BCE, doesn't that predate the rise of Greece?
Exactly. Yes. Greece comes out of what we call the relative dark ages,
yeah,
a little later. Rome is even later yet. Rome has its founding around 754 BCE. So it's at least a century after that. And Greece, about the same time. But Carthage is so good at sea exploration. We have stories about Hanno the Navigator, who may have not only gone around outside Gibraltar, the Pillars of Hercules or Heracles, out into the Atlantic, down the African west coast, further than Senegal, perhaps, and maybe even down to the Cape of Good Hope. So the navigators of the Carthaginians were famous, and they were not afraid to go across the open sea. Many of the cultures, for example, the Romans start out real flatlanders and landlubbers, as it were, not Carthage. Carthage and the Phoenician parentage were so adept at crossing bodies of water, and they founded all these colonies in beautiful harbor places, protected harbors, in Sicily, in Sardinia, in Spain, maybe even around the Red Sea area. So Carthage is founded, and for a while, of course, there's no problem because Rome hasn't even started yet.
Right. And that's when the problem arises, is when Rome begins to expand, it comes up against Carthage. And later on, we'll get to the Punic Wars and all of that. I want to talk a little more about the background of Carthage here. It was founded by Phoenicians.
Yes.
And Phoenicians I always have found fascinating because it was the Phoenicians that actually brought us our first alphabet.
Exactly.
Tell me the significance of that.
Well, because they were a mercantile society, because they were traders, they were always looking for a place to establish a foothold for trade. And they had a lot of monopoly on different goods. Purple dye, for example. They may have also been one of the first traders in opium, which was the divine gift of pain relief. We can talk about, you know, the opioid crisis, but you know, when you need pain relief,
right,
this was a gift from the gods. And
right,
Phoenicia traded in that. They also traded in something called frankincense, which was a religious incense needed. It's called frankincense, of course, much later. The very name for frankincense may even be similar to the name for Lebanon, Libanon.
Huh.
But whatever, they're traders. And so what we find, and this is a premise I think a lot of historians may not be always comfortable with, and in the book I'm probably a little bold on this, but I think it's okay to stir the pot. Often, we need to recognize that in a sense, all history is kind of economic history. And writing doesn't start out as literature. Writing starts out as accounting. Writing starts out as keeping the books, making inventories. Numeracy is much, much earlier by thousands of years than literacy. So you had this very unwieldy, cumbersome way of notation. And if you look at the earliest, say, cuneiform, proto-cuneiform Mesopotamian texts,
yeah,
you can easily see they're punching holes in the clay for counting. And then symbols are fairly abstract, but
right,
they're bulky. And you have hundreds of symbols that you have to reduce down.
And cuneiform is not an alphabet.
Well,
or it
can be later on, but it doesn't start out that way. So you start out with these sort of hieroglyphic systems, many, many, many symbols. Somebody simplifies that down to syllables, so we call a syllabary, maybe about 100 symbols. So if you look at early, let's say Hebrew, for example, you don't have vowels. And that's true in Egyptian too, but of course that's a very different language and writing system. But if you look at the old Hebrew and Phoenician, because they're practically identical, you have a syllable, ba, which is a consonant and a vowel. And that can be construed in different ways. Ba, bi, be, bo, bu, bi, and so on. So you write the consonant, the bite or bait, and then you write a vowel around it somewhere, above it, superposition, below it, you know, subposition, in front of it, preposition, you know, what we often call today prefixes, suffixes, and so on. We really don't have prefixes as obvious. A suffix is something below, subfix. Right. A superfix is something above. A postfix is something after. But the Phoenicians took that syllabary, that bulky system of 100 symbols of every time you have a consonant, and if you have 20 consonants and you have maybe 10 vowels, automatically you have a bulky system. Maybe if you only have 100 symbols, if you only have 6 vowels, and if you have maybe 15 consonants, you still have a system that's well into the hundreds. So the Phoenicians reduced that to now just a group, an alphabet,
yeah.
And we call that from the first two sounds, Aleph and Bayit. And they reduce it down to about 20.
And I would imagine that's more efficient.
Much more efficient.
So Carthage would become, just before Rome would become the power of the Mediterranean
exactly.
Sea in that whole era, the Mediterranean world, I should say.
Yeah.
But is the alphabet important for yeah. that? Did it give them an advantage?
Yes, it did, because everybody copied it. The Greeks copied it. The Greeks called it now Cadmean letters. They borrowed it because it was so much simpler to use. Now, they had very different words, but they used the same alphabet. The Etruscans borrowed it too. So if you look at all the Hebrews did too, all these early
Arabic.
Languages. Later on, Arabic uses a more cursive system, but early on, you do have all these people borrowing this alphabet because it's so efficient. You can say much more with less. And if the object of the Phoenicians is to trade with people, you want to have a system that's less cumbersome, that can be learned more readily, and so on. So it diffused throughout the Mediterranean world. And it really helped their transactions. They would go to a place, for example, in Italy, Pergi, the famous gold Pergi tablets, are written in Etruscan and in Phoenician. And the Phoenicians would say, look, we're very much like you. You have bronze, you have these things, you have gold, you have silver, you have these metals. We have goods. We have purple dye. We have luxury goods. And they said, but we kind of worship the same gods, whom you worship as Uni, who becomes Juno. The Etruscan Uni becomes the Roman Juno. Whom you worship as Uni, said the Phoenicians, we worship as Astarte. Hey, let's make a deal.
That's right.
And so that's kind of how they operate. Their writing system is less cumbersome. They're great negotiators. Herodotus doesn't like them because he calls them a little bit smarmy, you know, that they're just kind of greasy. They're just a little too, he says, ready to take advantage economically of people. And yet,
he says this about the Phoenicians.
Yes. And yet they were really good at it. They were very, very smart about negotiations. And yes, they probably did make a hefty profit. They became immensely wealthy. And when you go to ancient Carthage, you see what was called their secret harbor. And Hannibal, as a boy, lived right above that, apparently, where the nobles of Carthage lived. And it's a double harbor. It's a military harbor, behind which is a commercial harbor. The military harbor protects the commercial harbor. It looks kind of like a keyhole.
I wanted to ask you about that because you said history is really about economic history or something to that effect. I don't want to put the words in your mouth, but I always thought it was, but it's the military that everyone always writes about and remembers when we look at history.
Well, and this gets back to Hannibal in the sense, and I parlay this in the book, that Hannibal is very successful as a general as long as he has quartermasters who can pay out from Spanish silver. And by the decade, I may be getting ahead of myself here, but if you are going to have some kind of military protecting your merchant Marines. You have to be able to pay. And what's so different about the Carthaginians, too, they don't have a standing army of farmer-turned-militia like Rome. They have mercenaries. You have to pay those mercenaries. Very different from Rome. And Hannibal, for example, through his campaigns, the years of his campaigns, he can pay for the best military intelligence possible because he's got Spanish silver. Once he loses access to Spanish silver, and once his armies have to depend only upon loot and booty, his ability to maneuver, his ability to learn about his enemy is greatly reduced. And this is part of this point that you were stressing, that in a sense, all history is economic history. If you can't pay your army, and if you can't pay for information from your spy network on the opposing generals, that's going to really limit you. And I think we see Hannibal's overall strategy begin to diminish after he runs out of that Spanish silver, because Rome takes Cartagena.
Which is in what we call modern-day Spain.
Exactly.
That's right. I want to get into Spain here in a moment.
Yeah.
And I think this might be a good way to start even talking more about who Hannibal was. And that is by talking more about who the Phoenicians were, who the Carthaginians were. Is it one and the same to say Phoenician and Carthaginian, or does it get more complicated at this point?
It's a little complicated because, of course, everything's complicated,
yes,
right, Mitch?
Yes.
But you
especially
know,
when you talk about people,
yeah,
and who they are.
Yeah. The original Phoenicians, of course, are a Semitic people that is in current-day Lebanon.
Yeah.
And as I said, their language is very similar. If you read ancient classical Hebrew, you can probably read ancient classical Phoenician. And that's kind of how I got started. I was working on Celtic archaeology, I was working on Roman archaeology, and I was working on Phoenician archaeology. And guess what? All three converge in Hannibal. So it was very serendipitous.
Yeah.
Now, going back to this idea about what we call Carthaginian, the Romans, of course, often will call Punic,
yeah,
because Punica is the Roman version of Phoenices. Phoenices is the old Greek word for the Phoenicians, which may be similar to the purple dye word. And these are the people of the purple dye. So Punic,
Purple was their colors.
Yeah.
The official color.
It was. And it came out of the shells. And I have to share something if I can.
Yeah.
When I was funded by National Geographic for some of this fieldwork research, I was in this secret harbor in Carthage, looking out at this secret harbor, this round circle of the inner harbor, looking out right across to the Gulf of Tunis. Beautiful, you know, crystalline aquamarine waters and the Gulf of Tunis. And I'm walking around this harbor, kicking my feet through the sand, and all of a sudden, I looked down, and at my feet was a murex shell. And a murex shell was the shell that had this little creature, this sort of marine gastropod, that gave the purple dye. And I picked up the shell because I said, oh, this is evidence of the purple dye trade that the Carthaginians had. I picked up that shell and I looked at it. And I said, this is an amazing piece of history in my hand. Evidence of that incredible monopoly the Carthaginians, and before them, the Phoenicians had on this purple dye.
We are in conversation with Patrick Hunt. Patrick Hunt is an archaeologist, historian, biographer. He does teach at Stanford University. He also works with National Geographic, and we are in conversation about the great Carthaginian general, Hannibal, and his book that, about Hannibal. Well, it's called Hannibal, so there it is. I want to get to, and this gets us even more into Hannibal, because we're talking about Tyre and Lebanon, but at this point, 3rd century BCE, we're also talking about North Africa.
Yes.
And I want to get us into a controversy about Hannibal and what he looked like and what color he may have been. It was common in recent years to claim by some, for African-Americans even, to claim that he was black. You mentioned Phoenicians were Semitic people. What do you think what we know about Hannibal and who he was?
Yeah, it's as we started a little earlier about how complicated ethnicity might be. By the time of the 3rd century, the original Phoenician DNA, it's still there, but it's now intermixed with North Africans.
Yeah.
And some of those North Africans would have been not so much similar to the Berber or the Arab peoples there today, after the great move westward of Islam. But people thought for a long time that there's no DNA crossing the Sahara Desert from sub-Saharan Africa. And that's probably wrong. Today we have the string of oases of the Tuaregs and other desert peoples. But at that time, in the 3rd century, the Atlas Mountains were deeply forested. In Virgil's time, in the 1st century BCE, he talks about the great pine forests on Mount Atlas. At that time and later on, the huge plain under the Atlas Mountains had running rivers going to the Mediterranean. Those are all gone now. Massive climate change, deforestation, lots of reasons. But back in Hannibal's day, there was more what we can call egress to the south. There was more movement of peoples. So I don't think it's wrong to suggest that we can say there's probably some degree of Africanization of Carthage. How much is hard to say, but remember, so many of the soldiers were mercenaries from elsewhere, not just Carthaginians, Numidians, who would occupy part of what is now Algeria, Getulians, Libyans, Mauritanians, and a lot of those peoples would have had DNA that become, it's so mixed. I don't know how many DNA studies we have today that have actually looked at the ethnicity of Carthage. Partly, of course, and when you go to Carthage today, Rome did destroy Carthage, but it also built on top of it. And not enough DNA bone analysis has proven exactly what the ethnicity of Hannibal's people were.
Hmm.
As I said, it's complicated.
It is complicated. He probably wasn't white.
Whatever that means. You know,
light skin.
Yeah, it's so hard to say.
Right.
But then the Phoenicians themselves, because they're a more Semitic people, they would have probably been fairly heavily bearded and probably a higher melanin skin content than we have. And I always enjoyed the fact that an actor like Denzel Washington wanted to have a biopic on Hannibal. And as you probably know, somebody else who's wanted to play Hannibal is Triple X. You have actors that want to play Hannibal who have Africanized DNA themselves. So why not?
Yeah.
Why not? I don't think we should have any problem with that. Multiculturalism in antiquity
is a big deal. It's a big thing.
Well, and it's interesting. In Alexandria, in the Greek Hellenistic period, people didn't look at the color of your skin. You were Greek if you spoke Greek.
Yeah.
And I think because Hannibal has multicultural armies, there are probably many ethnicities and many languages in his armies. And it's a credit to Hannibal that he could manage a mass of people from many places who spoke different languages. It's a testimony to his probably really charismatic leadership and ability that they trusted him.
And yet, many people, if you say the word Hannibal, the name Hannibal today, will think of Anthony Hopkins, Hannibal Lecter.
Yes. And, you know, for a long time, and when you say this word exactly, people say Hannibal the Cannibal, Hannibal Lecter.
Yeah, yeah. That's
well,
right.
Funny.
Is there a connection to Cannibal?
There actually is, Mitch, and nobody really ever stresses this. In doing research for the book, I found out that one of Hannibal's sort of lieutenants was also named Hannibal because it's not an uncommon name. There's more than one Hannibal in Punic history. And when they were going over the Alps and after the Celts ambushed them multiple times, they lost a lot of their food and their pack animals, and people are dying on the way in the Alps. It's cold. It's high altitude. They're sick. all kinds of things. People are dropping like flies. Hannibal lost almost half his army going over the Alps. So this other Hannibal, his lieutenant, suggested, hey, Hannibal, to his general leader, he says, look, we've got a lot of people around and we're really hungry. We have to feed an army. And look, there are dead human bodies lying around and they're kind of in this refrigerator of the fresh snow. What do you say? Maybe we can have some human food, literally, cannibalization. And we're told by Polybius that Hannibal said no. But there is that historical precedent that someone suggested to him that he cannibalized the dead from his own army. Isn't that neat? And it's so obscure.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I don't say it's neat because the idea is abhorrent.
I understand. But I understand you were not advocating for it.
No,
yes.
But there's this historical kernel of truth in this precedent story.
Yeah. You mentioned the Celtics, and I found this interesting because when I think of the Celtics, I think of what, Northern, maybe Western, Great Britain, people that controlled the British Isle before the Jutes and the Saxons and the Angles came over, and that's the whole history about the English language and the Germanic people. And but in looking at antiquity, the Celtics could be found across most of Western Europe.
Exactly. And they probably start out somewhere in the Balkans, just after the Bronze Age, somewhere after 1000 BCE. They start off basically in the Alps in a place in Austria called Hallstatt. So there's this Hallstatt Celtic culture. And then they move north. They get all the way to Denmark. They move west through Germany. They move across France. They move all the way down into Spain. And fascinatingly enough, we can trace them with their mobilization. We can trace their migrations. And they had wagons, very elaborate wagons. What we call the Big Dipper today was the Wain, a wagon.
I believe it.
It was a wagon. Their constellation was a wagon. Isn't that neat? Then what we call Celts, that's because of Herodotus. He calls them the Celtoi. The Romans in Latin call them Gauls, but it's really the same word, a G, K sound at the back of the throat, followed by an L with some vowel. So you have a T in Celt, but Gaul is really G, K, L. It's the same root word. So Romans in Latin call them Gauls, Greeks call them Celts. But yeah, they were all over Europe, and they're even across the Alps in the Po River Valley. And that's one of the reasons Hannibal goes into Italy, because the Celts of the Po River Valley, the Boii, in Bononia, their capital, which is today almost the same word, Bologna, they call Hannibal to come help because the Romans are taking their farmlands.
Yeah.
And they set up new colonies, the Romans do, in what's called Placentia, which is today Piacenza, and in another colony that's Cremona. And so the Celts are begging for help to stop the marauding Romans who are advancing north through Italy.
Patrick Hunt, this is already a program, which I'm sorry, it's not 2 hours. So I'm going to go over some period of time here so that we could advance the story a little bit.
Sure.
About the rise of Rome and what that means for Carthage. And this gets us into the era of Hannibal.
Yes.
In fact, his father, Hamilcar. If I'm saying it correctly,
yeah, Hamilcar
fought in the first, was a general in the first Punic War.
And a good one.
And then we get the second Punic War and then the final third Punic War in which Rome flattens Carthage.
Yes.
But tell me about the rise of Rome and relation to the already existing power of the region,
sure,
Carthage.
Sure. Mitch, I'm so glad you asked this because this is a new development in this book that really hasn't been sufficiently stressed, I don't think. And, you know, this whole story of Hannibal is a turf war, too, because so many people have written books about Hannibal. And mine is just kind of the latest in this pile. But I think a new idea that's offered here is that because Rome was an agronomic land-based power. If you're farmers, you have to have land. You have to expand. And they're locked in on the west by the Tyrrhenian part of the Mediterranean, on the east by the Adriatic. Of course, those names didn't necessarily, you know, they weren't used then necessarily. But they can only go north, and they have to move to acquire more land. And that's why they step on the toes of the Celts and literally take their farmlands. So if you have an agrarian-based economy like Rome, and then you have a mercantile trade-based economy like Carthage, Carthage doesn't need land. It needs water. Rome needs land. And Rome's never going to let up. So almost at the start, you have an uneven playing field, and you have one culture which just wants to survive, another culture which has to expand. And the culture that has to expand, in this case Rome, is going to never, ever do anything but take over other people's land. So what at first, in the First Punic War, Sicily is this island between Carthage and Italy, you know, sort of like the ball on the at the end of the tip of the foot and the toe and the boot of Italy. So Rome is worried. The distance between Cape Bone, just outside Carthage to the north, and Cape Lilybaeum of Sicily, it's not even 100 miles. That was too close for comfort. So by the time Rome is expanded, by the 3rd century, Rome is really worried about Carthage being too close for comfort. Now, later on, you remember Cato emphasizes this in the Roman Senate, you know, kind of after Hannibal, and says, this is a fig. He stands up the Roman Senate. He said, here's this fig, and look at it. It's juicy and ripe. He may, you know, use it as a prop. He may even take a bite. Oh, delicious. He hauls up this fig, and he says, this fig is from Carthage. He's telling his fellow Roman senators, look, this is a fig that has not spoiled because the distance is so close.
Hmm.
He says, that's scary. And then he makes that famous statement in Latin, Carthago delenda est, or something like that. Carthage must be destroyed. Now,
that's where we get that term.
Yeah. And in the First Punic War, Hamilcar and the Carthaginians beat the Romans in so many battles that the Romans lose 100,000 soldiers and about 1,000 ships. And they're not really naval-based. They only win one battle at the very end, and the sort of Battle of the Gades Islands. And the Romans win that one battle, partly because of a storm at sea that takes down a lot of the Carthaginian power. And the Romans they dredge up a shipwreck from Carthage outside near Drepana, which is today Trapani, Sicily, in the west of Sicily. Wherever, they dredge up these boats, and one of the boats they dredge up, they look at it because they say, what makes Carthage such a great sea power? So they pick the boat apart. They take it apart, and to their astonishment, they realize the boat, every timber on this boat is labeled and numbered in some kind of alphanumeric system. And they go, what? These boats are mass-produced, kind of like paint by numbers.
Right, right.
And they copycat and make boats like the Carthaginians, and they build up their navy. And at the very end, in the First Punic War, when they conquer the Carthaginian fleet and they take over the West Mediterranean, they rename that part of the Mediterranean. And from then on, the Romans call it Mare Nostrum, our sea, making the point that it's no longer Carthage's sea, it's our sea.
In the First Punic War?
So 264 to 241, and that's the First Punic
Hamilcar
War.
Hamilcar dies?
Well, not yet. He will.
Just after. He gets ambushed.
He does in
Spain.
I'm
just moving us a little bit because of time here.
Yeah.
So he and Hannibal travels with his father to Spain
in
his military when his father is ambushed and killed.
Yes. And that, it's good to move it forward. Hamilcar is such a successful general. He's very angry at the Council of Elders in Carthage, the Gerousia, who are mostly merchants, bankers. They're not soldiers. Hamilcar says, you threw in the towel too quickly, and you accepted this treaty with Rome the Treaty of Lutatius, with this huge war penalty that we didn't have to throw in the towel yet. And he comes back to Carthage, and the council in Carthage is uneasy having this charismatic, brilliant general Hamilcar around. And he decides, after he puts down a slave rebellion, he decides, I'm going to Spain. I'm going to help pay this war penalty. I'll go to the new silver mines in Spain. And his boy Hannibal wants to go with him. Now, the story, we can't tell all the details. He's maybe 9 or 10 years old. And Hannibal says, Dad, I haven't seen you a whole lot. Can I go with you? And Hamilcar says, yes, on one condition. Come with me to the temple of Baal, your god. He's in your name.
That's what Baal means in Hannibal.
Yeah, Hannibal, favorite of Baal.
And Baal is a god.
Yes.
Of the mountains and
yes,
winds.
Yes, mountains and storms and winds. And thunder and lightning. And if somebody has pointed out that the surname of this clan, if it's true, is Barca, which kind of means lightning. And so Hamilcar, Hannibal's father, takes him to the temple of Baal in the story. We just have this anecdotal narrative that Hannibal then swears, if he wants to go to Spain with his dad, he's got to swear undying hatred to Rome, literally putting his hand on a still living sacrificial victim. And he does it. Now, we find this later on in his life. Whether it's true or not, Hamil does go with his father to Spain. And Hamilcar, with his cousin, Hasdrubal, they exploit enormous silver mines in Spain. Hamilcar is also not just building up money to pay back over this first war. He's also building up a war chest because he's not done. And he imparts to his son enormous military wisdom, takes his young boy with him. Battle after battle. And eventually, he's ambushed. Some say protecting his three boys. And then the soldiers elect, very soon thereafter, Hannibal is their general.
Soldiers elect a general? Is that normal?
Well,
is that common?
It's hard to say exactly the process, but they overwhelmingly support Hannibal as the successor to his father.
What makes Hannibal distinguishable in history? Why do we remember him?
Well, he's really an enigma. Here's the guy who wins battle after battle by brilliant tactics and yet doesn't ultimately win the war. Yeah. And if you look at the Roman Book of Stratagems by Frontinus, later at the end of the Roman world, Stratagemata it's called, there seem to be more anecdotes, more stories about Hannibal's clever tactics and strategies than anybody else in history, Roman history, there's. And Hannibal got into the heads of his enemies. He was a master at what we call psychological operations, psyops. And he used his military intelligence based on that Spanish silver that he took all the way into Italy. And he got to find out what the weaknesses of his enemies were with that military intelligence. And he exploited it. He also exploited the two general system of Rome. Rome had at that time an alternating rota of battle where you have a military veteran who is going to command one day and the political appointee is going to command the next day. Well, who's Hannibal going to choose to fight against whenever possible? Not the military veteran. And he's going to exploit the impetuosity. He's going to exploit the overconfidence. He's going to exploit the overeager, unprepared Roman political appointee general and gets into their heads. And Hannibal was really, really good at the psychology of war. And his soldiers probably had a lot less PTSD, post-traumatic stress syndrome, than the Romans because Hannibal taught his soldiers how brutal war is.
Tell me about the elephants.
Oh, yes. Can you imagine?
He used elephants
in war. He did.
Big elephants?
Yes. And probably both Asian elephants, Elephas Maximus, and African elephants, Loxodondron africanus.
And elephants had been used in war before throughout Asia.
When Alexander,
not Europe.
No. You're right. When Alexander went to India and fought with King Porus way back in the 4th century, mid 320s, he sees these massive cohorts of war elephants. And he's astonished by these tremendous beasts. So they eventually, after Alexander, make their way all the way to the Levant, and they're raised. Asian war elephants are raised in Syria. And then We know from coins and ceramics and other evidence that both African elephants coming up the Nile, coming north down the Nile, into Alexandrian Egypt, you have African elephants and you have Asian elephants, and both are used. Now, we used to think that African elephants could not be domesticated. I did a documentary in, of all places, Hollywood, a few years ago for this series. And they brought an African elephant named Susie. She was 25 years old. And even at 25, she had a lot of wrinkles because she's an elephant. She was so clever. She was probably smarter than half of us on the set. And of course, she stripped the vegetation in that Los Angeles canyon, just eating constantly. But Susie was so smart, she knew over 100 words and many commands, and she's an African elephant. And they tried to get Susie in this play, this movie set, to run over dummies, to charge over dummies, and she didn't want to do it. She was seeing their humanness, and she'd been trained to respect humans. Right. And they raised one of her feet and put it on a plastic head that was filled with red dye, to kind of squish the dummy head. She shook her head, her trunk flap, back and forth. She was really stressed out. She did not want to do it. She was really smart, but I think that poor elephant Susie may have needed an elephant psychotherapist after that.
Right. Elephants can be trained for war.
Yes.
And that's scary to think about.
It is. And the Celts had never seen these beasts before.
I went to the, I was in London last year, and I went to the Museum of London. Not the British Museum, which I spent plenty of time there too, but the Museum of London. You go in there, and there's this big painting of the Romans coming into Great Britain, and they're on elephants. And you just see the people who are there looking like, oh my God.
Yeah.
What is this?
It's the equivalent of an ancient tank.
Yeah.
It's an artillery weapon with the tusks and the charging and the mass and the momentum and all that. And whenever Hannibal, when he came through Celtic territory or Gaul, the Celts stayed away from those elephants. In fact, their horses didn't like them and would stampede at the funky smell of an elephant. I kind of wonder, and I say this in the book, that if you're a Celt and you've never seen an elephant before marching over the mountains, you might think
in the snow.
Yeah. What are elephants doing in the Alps, right? And you might, as a Celt, say, my God, it looks like a gigantic big boulder moving across the landscape because it looks like a big rock.
I there's so much to talk about, and the only thing we're missing in this conversation is time. And so we know about the rise of Rome. I think we know about the destruction of Carthage. And maybe this is a part of what I'm going to ask you, a part of that story. But why is it that the history we know about Hannibal is just from Rome, just from people like Polybius and Livy?
Yes. It's, to me, part of this enigma, this paradox of Hannibal. It's something that we often forget, Mitch, that we actually find out that the name Hannibal is more known than Scipio, the one person who vanquished
him. Yeah. Yeah.
We think we know more about Hannibal in terms of the popular presence of his name than about Scipio. And the Romans, like Polybius, for example, is a Greek aristocrat who's writing for the Romans. And in a way, if you play your opponent up really large, if you write a lot about him and his exploits and how clever he was and what a genius tactician he was, ultimately, if this guy who's a military genius at tactics, Hannibal, if he's so smart and yet your guy, Scipio, beats him, it makes your guy look even better.
Right.
But the tragedy of Hannibal, Hannibal used something, and I bring this out in the book. It's a new, totally perspective in the book. Hannibal always had a smaller army than the Romans, and he bolstered his arsenal with the environment, with nature, with the weather, with climate. At Trebia, he forced the Romans, this impetuous commander, Sempronius, to come across the river before the men even had breakfast, and they cross a freezing, icy river on the winter solstice. And boy, does that slow them down. Can you imagine coming out of the river with ice forming on your clothes and how lethargic you can be? He used fog at Lake Trasimen to hide in. He used the dust storm coming from Africa at Cannae in the eyes of the Romans. At Volturnus, one of the famous stories about Hannibal that I love is at night, the opposing general, who doesn't want to engage Hannibal in battle by now, not after Trebia and Trasimen and Cannae, or this is actually before Cannae, but they don't want to engage Hannibal in battle anymore. Stay kind of a war of attrition, pick at his heels. So between Trasimen and Cannae, you have this famous story. He's in Campania, rich Campania around north of Naples. Wonderful farmland, hundreds of cattle, thousands of cattle. Hannibal's taking it all. And now Fabius Maximus, the Roman general, thinks he's got Hannibal trapped in Campania on the west coast, west of the Apennines. Hannibal does something genius. He puts his men to bed early. He can't get out that one pass. So he puts his men to bed. He collects a lot of firewood. They take all that cattle that they took from Campania. And about midnight, a little after midnight, they tie all this wood to the horns of the cattle and they light it and goad them forward. And all the cattle are running through the night with torches in complete darkness with these torches, running up this hillside away from this pass. The Romans think it's the Carthaginians escaping, and they desert their posts guarding the pass, and they run after these cattle, and Hannibal with his army goes through. That is clever. So he's a master of clever ploys and stratagems and maneuvers.
Down to our final 2 minutes. It's what I call the tyranny of the clock. But I do want to get you to comment on this. Hannibal, he dies in exile?
Yes. He's after Carthage falls. Scipio, who's sympathetic because in a way Scipio's teacher is Hannibal. Hannibal, just before the Battle of Zama, said, what I was years ago, you are now. 20 years ago, you are now. Scipio lets Hannibal become the suffet, the kind of magistrate judge over Carthage. But then they want to turn Hannibal in to Rome, to take him away in chains. Hannibal flees Carthage, goes to Crete, then goes to Tyre, the mother city. Then he becomes a mercenary general for the Macedonians, for the Bithynians, and finally the Bithynian king betrays him. The Romans bribe him. And the last night of his life, Hannibal's in his fort on the Sea of Marmora. There are 7 secret entrances, and suddenly he has no men around. Where once loyal servant, and Hannibal realizes something's up. Where'd all his other people go? And he says to the servant, where did everybody go? And his servant says, this is not good news, Hannibal. Hannibal says, go check all the secret doors. Go check all our secret exit passages. His servant comes back from each one saying there's a Roman soldier standing outside each secret door. You've been betrayed. Hannibal does not want to be taken in chains to Rome. He does not want to go into enslavement. He does not want to be humiliated. He has poison. He takes it that night in his 60s and takes his own life rather than to be taken as a slave to Rome.
Patrick Hunt, thank you. I've enjoyed that greatly.
Mitch, thank you. What a pleasure and honor to be with you today. Thanks for sharing the Hannibal book.
Thank you for being here to talk about it. Patrick Hunt has been our guest, and it's Patrick N. Hunt. He is an archaeologist, historian, biographer. He teaches at Stanford University, works with National Geographic, and the book that we have been in conversation about is called simply Hannibal.